This is Bristol. It's Friday. Yes, it's 6 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Knowle, Gary Hopkins, and he's also Lib Dem leader. Also, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers is here too. After the 7 o'clock news, why the Pentagon is afraid to deploy some of the most powerful evidence they have against Julian Assange in court. The WikiLeaks founder's lawyers say he's a victim of psychological torture. Is that true? Also, a Zionist messiah? Is Netanyahu on a mission from God? Some of his advisers definitely seem to think so. And Malaysian President Mohamed Mahathir says there is zero evidence the Russians shot down his national airline's MH17 airliner over the Ukraine, and is demanding Malaysia be included in the Dutch inquiry, because so far, despite it being their plane that was brought down, Malaysia has been excluded. Also, Bilderberg 2019 debrief. The Saturday boat trip to lunch of the Bilderbergers in a castle execution chamber. A means, motive, and opportunity for the Iran war. At Bilderberg in Montreux. Despite the Iran war lobbyists Pompeo and Kushner being there in Montreux, it's the first time Iran and the Middle East haven't been on the official Bilderberg agenda. Is. Are the signs the deep state are preparing to attack Iran for real? Is the assault on and intimidation of UK pro-Palestinians in Jeremy Corbyn's opposition Labour Party? Will Corbyn himself be suspended for criticising Israel? And the sacking of one of the last supporters of Palestine from UK national radio, George Galloway, over a tweet about the Israeli flag. Was that justified? Also, the Gulf Cooperation Council desperately woo the Emir of Qatar, whose Al Jazeera channel exposed the Israeli embassy offering bribes to undermine pro-Palestinians in the Labour Party. That's all in the second hour after the US-owned Comcast news at 7. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 11 Celsius and light rain, which is a relief after earlier today. This weekend, highs around 16 Celsius, sunshine and some showers tomorrow, sunny spells on Sunday. Next week, highs around 16, some sunny spells and some showers, occasionally heavy. Next weekend, that's the 15th and 16th of June, highs around 16 Celsius, more sunny spells. Less rain, though, next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So joining me to review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Knowle, Gary Hopkins. Hi, Gary. Welcome to The Politics Show.
Hi.
Give us your take on the by-election result in Peterborough this morning or last night.
Well, clearly people act differently in a parliamentary election than they do in European elections. Different voting system, different issues. It's very interesting, actually, when people are asked after the European elections, why did you vote for certain parties? And looking at the reasons why they chose those parties, the most common response for people who continue to vote Labour, and they had lost a lot of votes, was, it's the party I've always voted for. So there's a loyalty factor there, which is dug in. And even, you know, we've got people who voted for other parties in the European elections who'll say that they're loyal to the Labour Party. And basically, I think in that by-election that the Labour Party worked hard on the ground. It was, you know, basically only about 10% of the available population actually voted for him, but it was enough to win. And the Brexit Party, you know, they don't have any ground game. They do not have local activists. They don't have the local knowledge to win a lot of seats. So I think that their strength is overestimated. And basically, even in the European elections, there was a third of the electorate voted for them, and some of the reasons for voting for them were rather protest.
Gary, many people say that because of the failure of the Labour Party and the Conservative Party at the moment, people vote for the Lib Dems out of a desperation.
I wouldn't call it desperation, but certainly it's seeking an alternative. And I think that for quite some years, we've had a lot of people who've agreed with us, but haven't voted for us because we've been totally disregarded, you know, 5-6% in the polls, which is where we were.
Is it nothing to do with Clegg and his alliance with the Tories back in 2010, the appalling results of the austerity programme that the Lib Dem Conservative Coalition, the LibCon Coalition brought in? Well, I mean, that's the big social consequence, isn't it?
In actual fact, the austerity was started by the Labour government in 2008. It wasn't an alliance with the Conservative Party. It was a coalition to tackle a job that needed done over a few years, which mostly got done, and then we went our separate ways.
Which was to strip out the welfare state?
No, it wasn't. It was basically there to actually get towards reasonably balanced books, and that was actually done. And after that, unfortunately, the Conservatives still want to, because that's in their DNA, wanted to carry on slashing. And we said, absolutely not. That's not the way we want it.
Martin,
and if you actually look at the published plans for Labour in 2010, they would have had larger cuts than the Alliance actually delivered.
Martin, the books haven't been balanced, have they? And they weren't balanced under the coalition. Actually, what we're now looking at is, I think it's about 1.7 trillion national debt now. All this talk of, oh, we're going to pay this debt back. Well,
Nobody said pay the debt back.
Go on, Gary, sorry.
No, we didn't say pay the debt back. What we said is stop the debt rising at a ridiculous rate, which it was at the time. And we had a worse annual balance than Greece at the time, percentage-wise.
Martin.
Right, well, I've made this point before. In actual fact, what happened? You cut too far too fast and the economy started slowing and the deficit started increasing. And at that point, the initial agreement between the Conservatives and the Liberal Party was that they were going to cut the deficit in one parliamentary term. It became absolutely obvious about three quarters of the way through they couldn't do that, which is what Ed Balls have been saying all along. So in actual fact, I'm not going to go back over this stuff, apart from to point out that it's just showed macroeconomic ignorance on the part of the Liberal Party leadership.
Well,
Keynes was turning in his grave.
What about macroeconomic ignorance on the part of Gordon Brown with his bailout, failure?
The thing about that was that if we'd had a proper Labour Party which had an intellectual hinterland, when the crash came, we'd have had something to say about it. But what happened? We've got new Labour people who thought that capitalism was indestructible and inevitable, and they hadn't thought about what happens if capitalism fails. Whereas, of course, the left wing of the Labour Party, people like me, have been saying capitalism's going to fail. We've been saying it for 40, 50 years.
It's 11 years now since capitalism really did fail in 2008. How is this going to end?
These are big topics, but of course, by bailing out the banking system, and it wasn't just in Britain, it was in the US and everywhere else, you've basically ended free market capitalism. Ultimately, if you're going to follow the free market playbook, you let the banks collapse.
What is going on with the banks? Because at the moment, they're giving virtually no interest, are they? And yet, if you want to borrow from them, you will find you do have to pay quite substantial amounts of interest.
They are getting free money from the government at zero interest rates, and then they're lending it on to people at a profit. Nice work if you can get it, but it's got nothing to do with the free market.
When you're getting no interest on your savings, that means you're going to have to go into the stock market to speculate, doesn't it? Which means you could lose it all.
In other words, what's happened as a result of the various incompetences that have been, we've got a massive asset bubble, which of course is inflation. It's not counted in the inflation figures, but it's a massive inflation. And ultimately, both left and right economists are clear about what's going to happen with this. It's going to crash. And of course, we should be talking now about what we're going to do when we crash, rather than saying, oh, we've sorted it all out, and all we've got to do now is talk about what we're going to do to mop up the mess. That's not the case at all. Not at all. And of course, the mistakes made during that era we're still living with. And there were genuine mistakes. I think the Liberal Party went into coalition with the Conservatives with some genuine desire to kind of do the best for the country and all the rest of it. But fundamentally economically illiterate, as was shown by the fact that the deficit started to increase because the economy started going down because you were cutting too far too fast. You can't cut that fast. Even if you want to reduce the fiscal balances, you've got to approach it steadily. If you approach it like a bull at a gate, you then start to crash the economy, and then of course you have to U-turn, which is exactly what happened. But of course that's all been forgotten. And anyway, we don't want to go back over that because that's all history. We've now got to talk about what we're going to do going forwards, which is much more to the point.
Martin, what's your take on the Labour Party managing to hang on to Peterborough? It is turnout was quite considerably down. It was 48 68%, whereas it was 67% in the 2017 general election. And voters in Peterborough backed Leave, it says here, it's 61%. In the 2016 EU referendum. If this had been a PR election here, proportional representation, it's quite likely that actually the Brexit Party would have won, isn't it?
Yeah, because they'd have picked up all the Conservative transfer votes, but of course it isn't. Britain is ruled under ridiculous constitutional provisions that go back hundreds of years.
We'll be talking more about that in a minute.
We can talk about it later. But I mean, listen, this is a Leave voting constituency, and if you top the votes up, Leave should have won. But under first past the post, with a split vote, they didn't, and that was always going to be the way. I mean, we had to.
It wasn't. It was quite a narrow victory, just by a few hundred. Yeah, but that Labour beat the Brexit Party. This is a party that only formed
a month ago. I'll just make a final point. Peterborough was probably the number one constituency in the country that Brexit Party hoped to take. If they can't take Peterborough, they can't take anywhere, and they need to go home and have a think about that.
So 700 victory of Labour over the Brexit Party. I mean, they do seem to be making inroads even into British Parliament, Gary, don't they?
In fact, the analysis, if you look at the results, adding up the pro and anti-Remain and giving percentages of how many of the Labour voters will remain or
whatever. Well, the percentages, let me just run through them. Hang on. The Labour Party are down 17%, Martin. Yeah. The Brexit Party plus 30%. The Conservatives are down 25%, Lib Dems up plus 9%, and the Greens got an extra 1%. So that was it, really. I mean, you as the Lib Dems are really only gaining 9%, whereas the Brexit Party gained 30%.
Well, not normally when you're third or fourth in a by-election, you expect to get completely annihilated. And I was very surprised that our vote actually quadrupled from a very low base, but you'd expect us to be completely wiped out. But if you add up the Remain votes there, they're roughly 50-50 with the Brexit votes. Which, considering that this was a very strong Leave constituency, is not good news for Brexiteers.
Martin.
That's right, I agree with that. I mean, obviously we can't read too much into a by-election result. There was a lot of local issues, and of course the Labour Party were able to concentrate Momentum's activists on this one seat. It's a bit different.
Are we ever going to get to the stage where Brexit isn't the main issue in an election? It would be nice to think that we could talk about social issues generally.
Well, in this by-election, the Labour Party took a strategic decision, because it's a Leave voting constituency, and many Labour voters are probably Leave voters, to concentrate on local issues. So the Brexit Party banged on about Brexit, and the local Labour activists were going on about fly-tipping and police numbers.
Okay, let's try and get Brexit out of the way today by discussing the feasibility or otherwise. The Conservative Research Group released this report this week called A Clean Managed Brexit on Wednesday, and what they're saying effectively is that they don't need Parliament's support. If a new Conservative Prime Minister decides that they are simply going to leave with no deal on Halloween, that they will be able to do so and ignore Parliament, whatever Parliament thinks. So, let's have a listen now to, and I get your comments after we've heard this, both of you, to the research group's former chair, Steve Baker, and spokesperson on the Daily Politics on Wednesday, looking at the Parliament and whether they can actually block a deal.
On the point of Parliament not allowing things, the Institute for Government has just put forward a paper in which it sets out in detail how Parliament will not be able to stop a determined executive from reaching no deal in October. You don't have to take my word for it.
Right.
What we want is an end state which is consistent with the offer the EU made to us in March last year, defence and security cooperation, a range of other issues, an advanced free trade agreement. That's what we should arrive at for the whole United Kingdom. We'll set out in detail how to do it. The papers are linked on my website. We know what to do. We know how to do it, and we want to get a deal. But
Do they solve the Irish border, which has been the main obstruction for your party over in Westminster?
So we're ready to table a treaty. We've got a treaty which government could adopt and table. Prosperity UK are working right now on full detailed arrangements for it. It is, of course, in the interpretive instrument agreed with the EU, which you should take as a sign that it's possible. Otherwise, surely the EU wouldn't waste our time with something it didn't believe
could
be done.
But Steve, do you accept there is a risk? How worried are you by the
prospect of a general election. If there is a new Conservative leader like Boris Johnson who says we will leave the UK at the end of October, come what may, in other words, will pursue a no-deal Brexit at that point if there isn't a deal agreed, because we know there are Conservative MPs who have pledged no confidence of government in that scenario.
I think they need to get a grip. Only until recently, it was a policy.
People like Hammond need to get a grip.
Oh, he absolutely does. He has been one of the greatest impediments to our successful exit from
the
European Union. Until recently, it was absolutely the policy of the government that no deal was better than a bad deal, and he really should stand by that. It is necessary now for us to find a different route to a deal with the EU.
Is he right, Rory Stewart, that actually, the EU will not accept reopening the agreement? They've said that categorically, and also that Parliament cannot stop no deal happening.
Well, so he's certainly right in terms of what the EU has said about not reopening the deal. Now, Brexiteers, like Steve, have taken a great deal of comfort from that IFG blog saying that a sufficiently determined Prime Minister could simply ignore Parliament and take us out. However, there's quite an important caveat in that blog, which is unless John Bercow, the Speaker, is willing to bend precedent. And what's the thing we know about John Bercow?
Well, he'll bend precedent.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's Steve Baker from the European Research Group and another MP, sorry, I'm not quite sure who that was, chipping in there, that actually a lot of this may be down to Speaker Bercow, Martin.
Well, yes. I mean, this is a very interesting, if I was teaching A-level politics, I'd say, isn't this fascinating? We're really finding out the British non-constitution, aren't we? All of these little ins and outs of it and what is and what is not allowed.
So it's all depending on whether Bercow will bend the constitution a little bit.
Well, not necessarily, because one of the things that we're talking about is closing Parliament down early for the summer so that if Boris Johnson won't have to face a vote of confidence. And then, of course, if they don't bring Parliament back until after Brexit's gone through, then we go through automatically. But I think that would be extremely provocative, to say the least. There would definitely be challenges in the courts, and of course the real IRA might go out and shoot a few police officers.
Well, it's not quite Pride's Purge, is it, in the Civil War, where the army came in and arrested all the MPs that were going to vote against Charles I negotiation.
It's very similar to the proroguing of Parliament by Charles I, which led to the Civil War, though. There's no precedent other than that.
Gary, what do you make of what Steve Baker had to say there? Because he's asserting, isn't he? Let's just remind everyone. What he's asserting there is that the Institute for Government is saying that a government under a new Prime Minister, Boris Johnson or whoever, would be able to just simply ignore Parliament and do this as a treaty, as a deal directly with the EU, and say to the EU probably, well, look, we don't actually want to have a deal, we're leaving now.
Well, I mean, I think there seems to be a sort of loss of memory here, because I think one of the most successful arguments that the Brexiteers actually had was to transfer power back to Parliament. And now they want to close it down so that Parliament can't actually decide who runs the country.
I thought that was Gina Miller that made sure that Parliament had to be involved in all this. Not precisely,
and she did exactly the right thing. But is the Brexiteers' argument, all this people, all this power with non-elected politicians in civil servants in Europe, we need our Parliament in charge, they said. And now what's happening? They want to close it down.
I'm sorry, but
Bercow will actually make certain the Parliament is
recalled. There was all this talk, wasn't there, last year about Bercow, the Speaker, being removed because he was a bully. Well, is it okay to have a bully making these big decisions?
I'd rather have him than Boris Johnson. Well, whatever his deficiencies might actually
okay,
well,
let's
be.
Okay, I think the Speaker is becoming an interesting character in this drama.
Oh, he certainly
is. Let's have a listen to what he has to say now.
Parliament will not be evacuated from the centre stage of the decision-making process on this important matter. That's simply not going to happen. It's just so blindingly obvious that it almost doesn't need to be stated, but apparently it does.
Well, he spelled it out in words of one syllable. There will be, when Boris Johnson, I think they've backed down now, Boris Johnson will be crowned before the end of this Parliament, and there will be an immediate vote of no confidence.
You're making out like this, that Boris is just going to be the new Prime Minister.
Hang on,
let me finish my sentence. There will be no real competition, like before when Andrea Leadsom stepped down on a Saturday and Theresa May was made the leader of the Conservative Party with no election of the
Well, one of the things that may happen is everybody else will step aside and he will just be crowned. But of course, that won't look good, so they may have to have some kind of contest to make it look as if there's a contest. But somebody like... what they may do is decide to put somebody like Rory Stewart on the ballot paper, who will be completely kicked out by their grassroots. But anyway, the point is, what could happen, what was also being floated, is the idea that Parliament goes on its summer holes early, so that Johnson doesn't have to face a vote of no confidence. Now, even if there is a vote of no confidence, people like Philip Hammond will probably vote for the government up to the point at which no deal Brexit becomes the definite policy. But Hammond has already made it quite clear, and it just takes him and a couple of others to vote against the government, and you've got a general election, and that's definitely on the cards here.
Let's have a listen to Steve Baker later on Wednesday. He was on the Peston show, where he broached this subject of the Tory leadership and who he would be supporting.
Really, there's three questions. Will the candidate win the leadership contest? Will they do the right thing when they're in power? And will they go on to win the next general election? Well, on the middle issue, and particularly with the grassroots, people are very confident that I would do the right thing if I were Prime Minister, and that's why I've got a load of grassroots pressure on me to do it. But members of Parliament, of course, are looking for somebody typically with cabinet experience at this point, and I can't escape the fact I don't have cabinet experience. It's also a matter of fact that I don't have a leadership campaign that's been building up for months or years. So if I were to say
that you're leaning towards Boris, are you going to tell me I'm wrong?
At this point, what I need to do is let the next couple of days go by and see where the conversations are with the candidates. Oh. But you'll know that last time round, I backed Boris. I was the last person to do a media appearance supporting him before he withdrew.
Now, there's a group of you, and you're very influential within the European Research Group. How many of your group, as it were, are still in play? And how many, you know, will you move as a group to one candidate as and when you make your own decision?
So the European Research Group strictly exists to employ researchers. It's become a synonym for all the Eurosceptics. But we're not in the business of arranging caucusing for the leadership campaign. But people have common views about leaving the EU. A real constellation of star Eurosceptics supported in a minor way that paper. Now, they agreed to give helpful comments and be associated with my paper. I'm very proud that they did. But the idea that they'll all caucus in the same direction for a leader is really for the birds.
You think it's unlikely? But on this whole issue, which I think is central to it, which is if you get a leader who is elected and adopts your approach, which is tear up the Prime Minister's deal, essentially do what you call a WTO terms Brexit, and then renegotiate a longer-term relationship with the EU after that, there is a lot of evidence that MPs would do their damnedest to block that. You won't get it through. Ultimately, any government proposing that will fall. You'll have a general election on the basis of that.
Well, I really hope your viewers will read the paper, because it has been written in plain English, and I hope people will have
it. Very clear.
Great. Well, I'm delighted. Look, there's so much to say here. First of all, no deal is not an enduring solution. It's not what I want.
No, I know.
I want a deal, as it says in the paper, of the character the EU offered us.
Sure.
An embassy...
But realistically, if we leave on October the 31st, that deal gets negotiated after we've left.
That is correct. Now, the great thing about this is there's a whole range of contingencies in place which the EU intended would give us a standstill from a no deal in March through to the end of December, a standstill, a continuation of present arrangements. Well, all of those arrangements, if there's any common sense, can be used and extended through next year. We can complete the set of arrangements and recommend to the EU that we continue tariff and quota-free trade, register that with a very simple FTA as a temporary free trade agreement under what's called GATT 24, and that allows us to just continue trading. Now, once we've
done... just check with this, but you accept there are both risks with getting that agreed by the EU and political risks that Parliament will try and block you.
Look, I wish we weren't in this situation, but right now, every course of action is risky, and we should be really ruthless in examining the courses of action forwards. But Rory said something earlier, and I have to disagree with him. It's not the case to say you have to get no deal through Parliament. When Parliament voted for the Notification of Withdrawal Act, it gave authority to the Prime Minister to trigger Article 50, the process of leaving, which meant, plain black and white, that we would leave at the end of the process with or without a deal. Parliament voted for it and enacted it. And what's happening now is parliamentarians seem unable to cope with the consequences of what they voted for.
There is, many would say, a contradiction in your position, which is that, you know, you believe Parliament is sovereign, so if parliamentarians change their minds, they should be allowed to pursue the consequences of what they want to do.
Fundamentally, what I believe is that political power must rest on the consent of the governed. Mm. Now, of course, we're governed by the Crown in Parliament with for an extra complexity. Mm. But if you're asking me, do I think that we are in really profound constitutional waters if a Prime Minister has to stand up for what the electorate voted for by being quite direct with Parliament? Well, yeah, it's a big deal. None of this is to be taken lightly, but if you want me to, I'll go through what I think the possible futures are, and I think the best possible future is the one I've set out.
Steve, as ever, it's a joy to have you on the show. You'll be back again soon, I know.
So there's felt like slapping Robert Peston at that point, because he's about to explain what he thought might happen, and then he said, oh, thank you very much, goodbye. But anyway, what do you make of what you just heard, Gary?
Well, I mean, one of the lies is basically, if we walk away with no deal, we just carry on and start renegotiating afterwards. The wonderful, easy way forward. The first thing is...
Well, he was saying if there's any common sense, and I've also seen Juncker over the last 10 days saying, well, actually, things are going to get very bad for the Brits if they go out with a no deal. So it doesn't look as if they want there to be too much common sense, because if everything's nice and easy for the Brits, in other words, they just carry on, they leave, and everything carries on as it was before, a lot of other countries are going to be looking at them and saying, well, maybe we could leave too.
The first thing is, there's a total misconception that the 38 million or whatever billion that was agreed is to pay off to get a deal, etc. It's nothing to do with that. It's money that we actually owe. Pension contributions, costs, things we've already signed up for. So whenever we go back, if we've crashed out and say, oh, we want a deal on this, they say, fine, what about the money you owe us?
But doesn't Brussels owe us anything?
No, that's a net figure.
Martin, what do you make from what you've just said?
Yeah, well, as he says, it's a net figure.
Really what most of that discussion was about.
No, it's not. But, I mean, the real problem is political, because if there's going to be a vote of no confidence in whoever becomes the Tory leader, that's pretty clear. They've kind of backed down on the idea of proroguing Parliament completely. Now, I think in the first stage...
Because Dominic Raab, for example, yesterday, just said he's not going to rule it out, and he won't rule it out at all.
Yeah, but he's not going to be Prime Minister. So it doesn't really matter what he thinks, does it? And, of course, if you're going to go to the level of playing this kind of level of constitutional chicken, then, of course, it's double or quits, isn't it? Now, the Tories are terrified of a general election because they'll be squeezed between the Brexit Party to their right and everybody else to their left, and they could just be wiped out. They need time to get a deal over the line and then try and sell it to the population. But unfortunately, they haven't got any time. The clock's been ticking down all the way. Now, they can try and run the clock out, but at that point, Hammond and others will just vote with the Labour Party and the Lib Dems and everybody else for a vote of no confidence. And that's the constitutional precedent, and in actual fact, if it hadn't been for the wretched Fixed Term Parliament Act, which was another of the silly things that were brought in during the Lib-Con coalition, already have had a general election.
Just to throw in this...
Which wouldn't have solved anything.
No, but at least it would have happened, you know.
Some news today. Brussels, according to the Daily Express, which I'm sure both of you read avidly every day...
I look at it every day, yeah.
That Brexit extension will be approved, apparently, and the UK could be facing a second referendum. The EU will approve another Brexit extension beyond October the 31st in the hope that a new Tory leader will call a second referendum.
Well, I think that the EU are basically being incredibly kind of forbearing. They don't want us to shoot ourselves in the head and splatter their wall with our brains. And so they will give us an extension, provided we've got some kind of, you know, we've got some kind of resolution coming. They don't want us to have a no-deal Brexit either. I mean, they'd rather have... They've offered a deal, which is negotiated with the Irish and so on, of a soft Brexit. People don't want that. Well, we'll give some more space.
Martin has said he's pretty certain that Boris Johnson is a shoo-in for a new Tory leader. Do you agree?
If he gets into the last two, yes, because the Tory voters have an average age, you know, well up in the 70s, 30% of them now, because they've had a big growth in membership, they're actually Brexit Party people who've actually signed up, and they can legally do that because Brexit doesn't actually have any members. So basically, a lot of people have joined who will swing the election Johnson's way if he gets into the last two. Now, there's probably a lot of people who want to stop him getting into the last two, but, I mean, let's face it, there's not many any sensible options there at all, is there? I mean, Johnson looked positively sensible compared with Rabb and all that nonsense. But, I mean, the Tories are in one terrible fix now, of their own making. Basically, if they go for a no deal, the skies will fall in. If they try to, they can't deliver a negotiated arrangement because they're fighting amongst themselves. If they don't deliver Brexit at all, we've already found out what happens to their vote. So basically, they're killed whichever way they turn. The only thing that they can do is justify a people's vote.
Martin, are you happy to see the potential end of the Conservative Party?
Well, I mean, I prefer the moderate Conservative Party to the Brexit Party, but I also prefer that basically we ought to have a change in the electoral system which would allow everybody to say what they thought, and then we could actually negotiate something sensible. Don't forget, this government is a minority government. It's not actually representing the majority of the people because of the first-past-the-post system, and therefore the internal fights within this minority then get to determine. It's like the Communist Party deciding what happens and everybody else just watching, yeah? Which what used to happen in Poland and elsewhere. And of course, they are the natural party of government. It's Eton College that's run this country for 200 years, and there they still are. But ultimately, these things are all coming to a head. Brexit, in fact, is only a symptom of the fundamental forces at work, and this includes the Wales, Scotland, and Northern Ireland all be solidly for Remain, basically, and therefore the state could disintegrate like Yugoslavia in 91.
If you're an EU citizen living in the UK, you will need to apply to the EU Settlement Scheme. The scheme is fully open and you have plenty of time to apply. It is free and all you need is your passport or ID card and to complete an online form. Support is available.
Sorry about that. Yes, so some support is available. We'll play another one of those ads. I don't know what happened there in the second half of the hour. Anyway, so yes, even the Brexit ads seem to be breaking down. There's a crisis with those as well. Martin, let's just get into another topic now. And we've got also this. There is a lot of talk, isn't there, about whether or not the British military is going to be integrated or integrating with the EU, and this is one of the things which has been almost brushed under the carpet as part of all this. Do you think that's been an issue? What would you suggest? Because this means that NATO would be playing a much bigger role in what the British military do or don't do if the British military was to become much more integrated with the other European countries' armed forces.
Well, I mean, this is mainly a sort of bugbear on the right. I don't see there's any evidence whatsoever that a European army will be anything other than a token force. Ultimately, Angela Merkel was talking about we've got to forge an independent Europe, independent of Russia and independent of the US. But I cannot see the European army, whatever it is, taking on the US. So, in other words, it's a lot of talk. NATO remains the unfortunately, I mean, we're talking about sovereignty. We need to get out of NATO. The French kicked the US forces out of France in the 1960s because they knew that the CIA were involved.
I mean, is there any real rivalry, do you think, between Brussels and Washington? Are they just basically on the same page?
No, well, Brussels is basically the junior partner. I mean, Kushner turned up at Bilderberg last week to tell them what to do, basically. The Europeans think they've got a say, but ultimately the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which I was discussing on RT earlier this week, the Americans are saying that we're going to block it. It's nearly built. They've nearly finished it to bring natural gas from Siberia to Germany. That's bit ready to be built, and the Americans are saying, no, you can't do that.
So what's the point of the EU, Gary, if the Germans can't stand up to the Americans?
I think Europe as a whole can stand up to the Americans. There's a different different philosophy in European politics from American politics. All you've got to do is watch Trump for 5 minutes and you'd know it.
Okay.
It's very, very different. And I seem to remember the D-Day celebrations, that they were celebrating several countries, a lot of countries, actually effectively joining forces in one army, but they still were under British command or American command or whatever, but they worked together.
Yeah, they were under US command, weren't they? And we've heard quite a lot this week, Martin, about how D-Day was the big turning point of the Second World War.
Yeah, well, of course, I mean, the last D-Day commemoration some years ago, Angela Merkel was there representing Germany, but Putin wasn't there to represent Russia because we're not friends with Russia anymore, even though they did the majority of the fighting. There was about 20,000 people killed on D-Day. That would have been a single day's fighting on the Eastern Front.
So the turning point was real turning point?
Stalingrad, of course. What else?
So what was that? November, December 1941.
2 years before, yeah.
Yeah, so that's actually, what, nearly 3 years before,
yeah,
actually.
Yeah.
There's an element of propaganda to this, Gary, where the turning point wasn't really D-Day, it was Stalingrad, and it wasn't the liberation of Europe, because the Russians were already very much advanced in doing that.
There was all sorts of turning points and important points during the war, not just one, not just another. And basically, why Germany was defeated, people from all political sides looked at it and thought, we're not having this. And, you know, people, the Russians, the British and the Americans and everyone else said, this is important for the world to stop this happening. And they came together. And alliances are important.
Martin, do you think that what those people died for, all those war memorials over Britain, we can still be proud of those? Because some are questioning whether human rights and civil liberties are still as well adhered to in Britain as they were in the sentiments at the end of the Second World War.
Well, there was a reformist mood in this country at the end of the Second World War, because Churchill, of course, expected to be re-elected, and he wasn't, largely with the forces vote, because people who'd been out there doing all that stuff said, we're not coming back to the Britain with no work and no prospects. I mean, what's very significant to me, as I just said earlier, previously, when the Ukraine crisis broke out, there was the Normandy Four. Putin was talking to the French president and the German chancellor and the Ukrainians about coming with the Minsk agreement and so on. But in actual fact, Putin hasn't been invited this year. So the Germans are represented at the commemoration of D-Day. But the Russians not.
And what about the way that our armed forces are now celebrated almost in a World War II style fashion with the campaigns in Afghanistan and Iraq and places like that?
Well, I think it's very odd, actually, because when I was growing up, there wasn't such a fuss about it as there is now. People just took it for granted that we did the right thing in the Second World War, and by and large we did, but we don't go on banging on about it. And, of course, it's rather pernicious that every little colonial war we've had since is conflated with that great struggle. You know, when the British were torturing their way through Malaya and Kenya in the 1950s, and it was very serious. They killed up to 250,000 people in camps in Malaya, according to latest research. Not in Malaya, in Kenya. According to latest research, as bad as anything going on in the Soviet Union at the time, that's conflated as, armed forces doing their job just as storming on the beaches as D-Day was.
Well, what about Iraq and Afghanistan, though? Because this
is a
whole other ball game, isn't it?
Well, that's right. So, in other words, the Second World War was a unique struggle. And the idea that all the wars that Britain has ever engaged in were good wars is patent poppycock.
Well, let's have a listen now anyway to David Ellis, who's a military consultant, talking about why he believes the Defence Secretary Gavin Williamson may have been sacked, a question we were wondering and scratching our heads about at the time.
Parliament is supposed to have the competence over, yes, of course, the troops swear allegiance to the Crown, but of course, ultimately, in the tripartite relationship there, that Parliament signs off on the tax and the bill, so there's taxation with representation in order to pay for it.
Also, what do you make of the resignation or forced resignation, the sacking of Gavin Williamson? I mean, do you know any the reasons why he might have been pushed out? Because it did seem that was done for a reason. I mean, it was obviously just before the local election, so it gave Theresa May a sort of little boost. It made it look like she had some sort of authority. But have you any idea where he stood on these matters, as he was Defence Secretary?
Well, there were two key data points. Firstly, the Huawei stuff was old news. GCHQ knew about that in 2007, give or take, as best as I know from a GCHQ source. Secondly, Gavin Williamson was briefed a very short while ago by a top government defence advisor who was working with Major General Julian Thompson in Royal Marines in campaigning against Defence Union. And he was briefed about Defence Union, and he wasn't getting the information from within the Cabinet Office, and said at the point when he realised what was actually going on, there was no way he would sign off on Defence Union, and he was being asked to. So that is a data point. So I've got first-hand source on that, so I know that had taken place, and I know the people that went in to see him. So whether that had some bearing on him being, you know, politically pushed out, who's to say? But that did happen.
So that's European Defence Union. Gavin Williams-Martin refusing to sign off on it, apparently, according to an insider.
Well, yes, but I mean, the fact is that it's a red herring. The European Defence Union is basically, there's no danger whatsoever of a European force replacing NATO. NATO should have been disbanded years ago. So I'm not saying this with any love for NATO, but a European Union Defence Force could, for example, have intervened in Yugoslavia instead of NATO if it existed, but of course it didn't exist and they couldn't, and therefore the Americans came in and took over. Now ultimately the European Union could have developed in a position to be a separate force in world affairs, but it hasn't, because basically it's a squabbling bunch of toddlers, and they can't actually agree amongst themselves.
Won't those toddlers generally do what the Americans tell them to
do? Well, exactly. That's the way the Americans like it. What happened in Yugoslavia was the Vance Owen plan, which is the EU plan to settle the business, was vetoed by the Americans, and they said to Izetbegovic and the Bosnians, fight on, because we'll give you a better deal. So they fought on for another 2 years. Loads more people died. Then Holbrooke was brought in to fix it all up, and he got exactly the same deal that was already on the table 2 years ago, but at the point it was an American deal, not an EU deal.
Anyway.
And the Americans were trying to assert the fact that you can't do stuff without us,
okay.
And that's what they made that stick.
Back to Prime Minister's questions. We're starting with Prime Minister's questions now, getting into that, and this is about the liberation of Europe, apparently D-Day, discussion about Trump and Corbyn and whether Corbyn should have been at the state banquet.
Tim Lawton. Mr Speaker, as the Chancellor says, today in Portsmouth and tomorrow in Normandy, we honour the veterans and the 150,000 British, American, Canadian and other allied troops who led the charge to liberate Europe against the real Nazi scum. So does my right honourable friend agree that when a minority of hate-fueled demonstrators yell Nazi scum in the faces of American tourists and intimidate others legitimately welcoming the visit of the American president, however we may take issue with him, and regrettably spurred on by certain honourable members of this House, that they attack the greatest alliance of free nations and they demean the memory of those brave troops and veterans whose very sacrifice secured the right of all of us to free speech?
Mr Speaker, I agree with every word that my honourable friend has just said, and I think that it's worth reminding ourselves that the fact that we and our neighbouring countries across the Channel enjoy today the freedom to express our views publicly, to assemble and to demonstrate our points of view, to argue peacefully against one another in this place, are derived from the courage and the sacrifice of the wartime generation, whether from the United Kingdom or the United States of America or our other allies, and we should remember and salute that courage and that sacrifice and not demean it by the sort of disgraceful behaviour to which my honourable friend refers.
Well, that's David Lidington there, who's a cabinet secretary, standing in for Theresa May, the zombie prime minister, who's standing down finally today. Gary, what do you make of this whole business of Jeremy Corbyn not attending the state banquet and instead going to this rally, where anti-Trump rally, effectively?
Well, where he went is irrelevant. He was right not to put up with this nonsense of Trump getting a state visit. And in fact, Vince Cable did exactly the same thing. He stayed away from it as well. They're trading partners with people we need to do business with. But giving Trump all that ceremony and blessing and forcing the Queen to go through that was quite frankly disgraceful. And America has, over the last few years, not been the party that was there and helped us during the Second World War. I'm afraid that, you know,
if there's a general election, and he's asked Martin this actually, if there's a general election, Martin, and Jeremy Corbyn's Prime Minister, he's going to have to talk to Trump. So it's almost like he had a bit of a hissy fit.
Well, no, because in actual fact it came out that he approached Trump privately for a private meeting, and Trump told him to Trump
the Queen
to
is
stuff.
Asking him as leader of the opposition to go along to a banquet. Why doesn't he go?
Because it would compromise him with his own supporters.
Don't you think it makes him look like he's a protester and not a statesman?
No. Protesters end up as statesmen. Think about Nelson Mandela. Well, you don't have to go along. He offered to talk to Trump outside a state banquet. Let's have a chat about what's going to happen. And then Trump, that was all off the record, but Trump then decided to tell everybody that he'd approached him and he told him to get lost. And then Corbyn had to say, yes, well, I did approach him to talk to him privately.
I mean, surely as any kind of diplomatic person will talk to the person and be a critical friend to them.
But no, you'll talk to them. You don't have to go to a banquet with them. There's no talking at the banquet, is there? You just sit there looking like a stuffed turkey and eating turkey.
Okay, so what about
Corbyn was wrong with some of the other visits that he has taken part in, and he's put up with other people that possibly he should have been boycotting them as well.
Well, perhaps you'd like to name some of the people he should have been boycotting.
Well, President Xi, for example.
Has he spoken to President
Xi? Well,
there
was some sort of do for President Xi when he came over here.
Well, did he go to the banquet?
Yes, he did, actually.
All right, well, there you are.
So why so?
But he should
have done. For example, is Trump a racist?
I think some people in America would say he was when at Charlottesville.
But is he? What would you say?
No, yes, he is. Yes, he is. I mean, he stopped people from certain countries with Muslim majorities coming to
but that's
the country.
Because he's been advised by his national security people. That
he made that up.
Generous.
You could keep out individuals perfectly straightforwardly. For example, no Iranians can come into the US because he banned them. That's racist.
Why?
Why?
It's a security issue.
No, it's not a security issue. You can ban individual Iranians. Why ban all Iranians? Iranians come here all the time. We don't ban them. Why? There is plenty of things to suggest that he is a racist. He gets too easy a ride because he's such a joker. Everybody thinks he's safe. He's not safe. He's a very dangerous person.
So it's okay to talk to Hamas, the IRA, but not to Trump?
Yeah. It is, because Hamas and the IRA actually represent people we agree with, whereas Trump we don't agree with.
What do you think about that?
Well, I think you speak to everybody and try and negotiate with them, and I've got no problems with that. But giving them a state visit is a different matter altogether, and it was May to try to boost their own image, and quite frankly, it was shameful that he was actually invited to have a state visit, and you know, I'm afraid that there's lots of Americans, the majority of Americans are very embarrassed.
Isn't
about
the best
Trump?
Way to have some influence with the Americans to be nice to them and give them a nice supper?
Well, we can certainly do trade with America, and we do huge amounts of trade. And because we don't fate a man who is disliked by two-thirds of Americans, his approval rating is through the floor, and don't have him coming along to Buckingham Palace, is no disrespect to America. It's just not showing undue respect to a man who's not due it.
Anyway, so we had David Lidington standing in for Theresa May at Prime Minister's Questions. On the Labour benches, it was Rebecca Long-Bailey, who I think did actually a very good job standing in for Jeremy Corbyn, and here she is now talking about actually something which is including in her discussion about UK energy policy, the Swansea Tidal Lagoon, which is, of course is an absolutely brilliant and wonderful idea, which the Conservative Party have, well, sunk in the mud.
Rebecca Long-Bailey!
Well, this is absolutely staggering. The government promotes fracking, backed by only 12% of the public, effectively blocks onshore wind, backed by 79% of the public, new solar is down 94%, home insulation is down 98%. Mr. Speaker, Parliament declared a climate emergency, yet there is no evidence this government takes this seriously. We need a green industrial revolution to tackle climate change. And alone, Swansea Tidal Lagoon would have required 100,000 tonnes of steel, mainly from Port Talbot, but the government refused to back it. Can the Right Honourable Gentleman tell us what the government has actually done since signing the steel charter to support our steel industry?
Mr. Speaker, if one looks at what is actually happening in the real world rather than the ideological tracts which the Honourable Lady appears to spend her time reading, you will see, Mr. Speaker, that there are about 400,000 jobs already in low-carbon businesses and their supply chains throughout the United Kingdom, and scope for much more low-carbon growth to support up to 2 million jobs in the future. We now have received advice from the Independent Climate Change Committee about how to time and to legislate for our transition to a completely decarbonised economy, and we will bringing forward our decisions later this year as to how and when we will be taking that action.
So, Gary, this is a little bit of an own goal, isn't it, here? Because the Conservatives have completely... I mean, she's asking about energy policy and industrial policy and steel as the British steel industry is collapsing. And also the Fords just closing one of their engine plants as well. It looks like all our heavy industry is basically just floating away down the English Channel.
There are severe problems.
Or the Bristol Channel,
pressures.
In this case.
And basically, the Swansea Lagoon, the cancelling of that was criminal. It really was an excellent scheme. Would have given a Britain a lead in renewable energy, which was extremely valuable.
The funny thing is, of course, the Queen is backing this Maygen project up in Scotland, which is tidal energy. So, same sort of idea, really, making energy from the tides.
Yes.
I mean, you get quite annoyed by all that mud, you know, because it's a bit muddy. It's much nicer to have a bit of sand. But the great thing about the mud is a massive amount of tide going in and out, and you can generate power from it.
Yes, an absolutely excellent scheme. Which should have been backed, and quite frankly, short-sighted policy to actually cancel it. And I don't know if you remember, but about a year or so after the end of the coalition government, a huge group of environmental lobbyist groups came together and decried what the Conservatives had managed to dismantle in about a year. They said, we've gone from the greenest government ever to the greyest, and they were absolutely right.
Martin, are the Labour Party just picking up all the Green Party's policies here?
Well, I mean, if they're the right policies, then there's no reason why you shouldn't, is there? I mean, it's no shame in stealing good clothes, which are still wearable, is there? What's really interesting is the lack of industrial policy going back years. And interestingly enough, the guy that's just lost the vote in Peterborough, he's actually a director of the hedge fund company.
You mean the Brexit Party guy?
Yeah,
Brexit, came second. Yeah,
yeah. He's actually a managing director of the vulture capitalists who've just wrecked what's left of British Steel, and they've done quite a lot of similar asset stripping in other companies. He's a millionaire, used to donate to the Tory Party, and he made his money by doing that.
Okay, let's have a look now at the planning inspectorate, because there's I think fascinating, probably most people say this is boring, Tony, but a question about the planning inspectorate, because there's such an enormous number of student flats and things like that going up in Bristol at the moment. When the companies that are applying, these developers and speculators, appeal after a city council planning committee turns down an application, the planning inspector would get involved. But it turns out that they don't actually want to talk to MPs.
Joseph Johnson.
Mr. Speaker, Pett's Wood is designated an area of special residential character in the London Borough of Bromley, but it's suffered from inconsistent decision-making at the hands of the planning inspectorate, which I feel is unaccountable. Would my right honourable friend use his good offices to help me secure the meeting I've long been requesting, which the planning inspectorate has for some reason consistently declined?
Well, I'm very happy in the first instance to ensure that my honourable friend has a meeting with the relevant minister in the Department of Housing, Communities and Local Government, and hope that will enable him to find a way forward.
It would be a gross discourtesy if it were otherwise. Extraordinary that the honourable gentleman should have to ask for a meeting, but there we are, he's going to get his meeting.
Well, it's interesting. Very, very short reply by David Lidington there, Gary. And I know you're going to be on one of the Bristol Planning Committee soon. Actually, what he's saying is that this planning inspectorate is not really listening to local MPs. In fact, he won't even meet local MPs. So they don't sound very accountable to me, even though they're making these massively important decisions.
I think there's a considerable concern that they're not as open as they should be, and what they actually do and the way they make their decisions should be more open to public scrutiny. I can understand them not wanting to have behind-the-scenes meetings with individual MPs, because there could well be then be perception that they've been leaned on politically.
Well, anyone that's driven up and down the M5 recently from here up towards Gloucester will have noticed this enormous, it's a total eyesore in the middle of the fields right next to the motorway, and that is an incinerator project, and the Gloucestershire Council's been taken to court by a community group over a £650 million incinerator contract. A Stroud-based community group's taking Gloucestershire County Council to court to challenge the legality of the £650 million incinerator contract. They're claiming in the contract for the construction of the waste incinerator located near Junction 12 on the M5 near Gloucester is illegal. First hearing is starting at Bristol High Court, Redland Street, where both the community group and the council will sit before a High Court judge. It was negotiated a contract with the company responsible for the site, Balfour Beatty, £150 million increase in the cost of the original contract. But Martin, these are massive amounts of money involved. When a planning application is approved, that's a cheque sometimes for up to £1 billion for the people who want it.
Well, that's right. I mean, I'm not an expert on planning. I've never sat on any planning committees. But obviously, you want transparency. But as Gary's just pointed out, if there's going to be private meetings with individual MPs, that opens them up to being, you know, are they under political influence?
Well, the reason they're doing that is because all the local community are coming to their MP and saying, this decision, it looks illegal to us. Well, and it looks as if someone's been bribed. I mean, that's the obvious implication.
Let the law take its course, isn't it? You know, let justice be done though the heavens fall.
Okay, well, let's see what happens with this. We'll be following this incinerator case for sure.
It's been rumbling on for quite a number of years, and really at the early stages it was pretty obvious that the numbers did not add up. It was bad business and bad environmental
policy. They don't separate out recycled waste either, do they? Just burn everything. Anyway, it's time to finish our first hour now. We'll be back in the second hour. Hopefully we'll be some news now, but there doesn't seem to be any news turning up. Before you go, Gary, what planning committee are you going to be on and when?
Well, I'm on the B planning committee. You don't know in advance which items you're going to be looking at. And basically, the planning committees are quite large, so one person will have very limited influence.
Is there an A planning committee?
There is. There's an A and a B, and it's whichever as a case comes up.
Now, I don't know if you're allowed to tell us, but apparently the chairs of these committees are both appointed by Marvin Rees, the mayor, and they're both people who are very big fans of the mayor and tend to do what he wishes them to do.
He didn't get it right exactly then, because the one of the chairs was Sultan Khan, who actually just left the Labour Party not that long ago.
Okay, so maybe he'll be replaced soon. We shall see. Anyway,
well, he has been replaced, obviously, because he was put there as a Labour member, and he's no longer a Labour member.
Okay, well, it's interesting. That was all over Stoke Lodge, that controversial decision at Stoke Lodge. Anyway, so that was what you got, folks, instead of the Comcast news at 7 o'clock. A little bit of insight into dodgy planning deals and dodgy planning committees here at Bristol City Council from one of the new members of the planning committee, Gary Hopkins. Thanks very much for joining us.